At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, that's Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
All right. We've got an interesting show. All right. Now, this is, you know, we've done quite a few shows on out-of-body and near-death experiences over the year. Years, rather, not over the year. Although we've done a few already this year as well. But we're expanding, and I saw a book, Tim, that captured my attention, and after reading it, I knew I wanted to speak with this guy, simply because his story is unlike any other story, I think, that we've covered on the show to this point.
Okay.
He has a brand new book coming out in July called Shine On, The Remarkable Story of How I Fell Under a Speeding Train, Journeyed to the Afterlife, and the Astonishing Proof I Brought Back with Me. So it's a nice short title, very easy to remember, Tim.
Oh, yes, yes.
But don't worry, we've got the full title of the book on today's program. Plus, we have a link to our guest's book and a link to his website so you can find out even more information. But when I read in here, Astonishing Proof That He Brought Back with Him, I started reading a little bit further into the description of the book. And again, we've had people come back and they've journeyed the tunnel of light. They've spoken to loved ones. They've seen Christ or Buddha or Ronald McDonald, whoever they believe in, makes their appearance and gives them these benefits of information. But this guest came back with something a little bit more undeniable, something that just transcends what would already be supplanted. Because I think that's been yours and my biggest problem with the near-death experience. People have talked about near-death experiences for so long.
Yeah.
And talked about the journey of the soul through the light, the renewal of life, the voices, the appearance of a godlike creature or family members. That how do we know that our brain is just not predisposed to these ideas, and it is, it's closing down, it's trying to make sense of this experience, right?
True.
So we've often questioned that, but what if you were able to bring back something that really couldn't be denied? Because everybody knows you didn't have this before this near-death experience, but is now a part of who you are in a very dramatic, life-altering way. So that was the aspect of this story that really grabbed me. Joining us for today's program, David Ditchfield. And David, thank you so much for joining us and spending some time here today.
Oh, thanks for having me along. It's a pleasure.
Well, let's go back in your life a little bit, David. Prior to your accident, had you ever had a belief in the supernatural, the afterlife, anything like that?
No, it hadn't really come into my life at all. The place I was in my life was all about really just kind of living day to day, you know, and making sure I got enough to put a meal on the table, as it were. And so, no, it really wasn't a part of my life whatsoever.
All right. So you'd heard most likely stories of near-death experiences. Even those people that don't really seem infatuated with the paranormal have heard these stories on different TV shows and in movies and things like that, right? Had you ever really kind of been exposed to that aspect?
No, near-death experiences was a whole new thing that I'd only found out about after I'd had mine. Once I'd come back from the hospital, you know, I was charged with it all and wanted to find out exactly what had happened. So, of course, I went online and started researching, and then I found the phrase near-death experience, and I thought,
okay,
that's
so,
it.
So you really had no exposure to this entire concept going into your own experience?
Not at all, no, not at all.
Now,
I mean, my life was gone.
I was going to say, you know, I don't want to jump into the accident and what happened first, but now having the hindsight, do you see through the kind of lens of your new perspective, strange things about your life before this incident that maybe you hadn't really analyzed or looked at prior to having this moment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really look back now and realize that the whole of my life was kind of leading towards this, as it were. You know, I had I was down on my luck, basically, before my NDE. I was living in London at the time, and I was I'd left school without any qualifications, so I was struggling to get by. I was picking up mainly manual laboring work, freelance, and I wasn't really that good at that either. I was looking around, seeing all these other guys just kind of constructing brick walls while I was still on brick three, and I just figured, well, you know, I'm not fitting into life. So all throughout my life before, it was a struggle. But I did realize that everything was leading towards the actual event that was to change my life.
All right. Well, let's walk me up to that day. And what was that day like before the event took place?
Well, basically, I was struggling to get by. I was pretty heavily dependent on alcohol. I was drinking to sort of like quell, you know, the pain and sort of like fill the void, as it were, as a lot of people around me were at that point in the kind of that kind of environment I was working in. And my sister was living in Cambridge, and she said, why don't you come and stay with us for a few days? You need to really get away and get some fresh air and come stay with the family. And I said, that'd be great. So I made my way up there to stay with her, and I was only really due to stay for as long as it took, you know, like a day to a few weeks, as it ended up. So I'd gone up, and a friend of mine, I'd met again, this is fate, you see, I'd met up with somebody only weeks prior to me leaving for my sister's, who I'd got this real connection with, and I really got on with her. And she said, I want to come and visit you while you're staying at your sister's. You know, she was kind of concerned about me, but also I think, you know, we got this connection, so she wanted to come and see me. So she jumped on a train from London and came up and ended up staying a few nights. And she had to go back down to London. So I saw her off to the rail station. And, you know, that's pretty much where things started to turn a huge corner. I was helping her on the train with her luggage. She got a heavy bag. And I got on. And we were just saying goodbye. I gave her a big hug and I kissed her, and then I heard the emergency sort of buzzers going off, and she said, quick, the doors are about to close. I said, yeah, I know. And I stepped back, and as I stepped back, the bottom edge of my coat got caught in the automatic doors, and I thought, I'm trapped, you know. I was tugging away at it.
Oh, my God.
So it was pretty scary because I thought, this coat is not going to get released. It was a cold day. It was a February day, and it was like a very thick sort of quality sheepskin coat that I was wearing. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to get this out. So I looked around to see if there was a guard on the platform, and there was no one in sight. In fact, there was only one other person on the platform itself. There's this guy who was stood behind me, and he'd been seeing off his girlfriend. And I remember he shouted to me, you know, get your coat off, mate. You know, take it off, take your coat off. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to do that because of the density of this coat. I knew that it would be clinging to my clothes underneath, and it wasn't a quick job. So I basically started shouting out for help. You know, screaming out for help, please help me, you know. And nobody came. So I was pressing, there was like two automatic open and close buttons either side of the doors, and I was pressing on those, and they didn't activate anymore. They were obviously on lockdown.
Now, are the people inside the train seeing this?
Well, they weren't really, not to my knowledge, other than my friend Anna, who I was seeing off, who was like literally stood right in front of my face, the other side of the glass, with just the look of sheer horror on her face, because, you know, she had to watch the whole thing unfold. You know, it was just, and, you know, there wasn't that much time. You know, once those doors had closed, the engines were revving up to go, and it wasn't long before the train started to pull out of the station with me still attached. Yeah.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah, it's not something that I'd recommend. And yeah.
All right, you're being dragged. This is closed in on you. Again, you can't get your jacket off in time. You're scrambling. What happens next?
Well, basically what happens next is, oddly enough, I found myself thinking, well, this is it, you know, I'm probably going to die at this point, you know, and I couldn't see myself surviving. And I thought, I've got to go into survival mode. And I had this vision came into my head. I thought, hang on a sec. I remember seeing this news item about a week or so previous, where a small child had been thrown from a burning apartment block from the third floor and had survived. And they said in that item that it had survived because it was a very young infant. And they said that babies don't tense up, you know, they're relaxed. So I just figured, right, that's what I've got to do. Just relax. The train started to pull out. The engines were like really revving up by this point. So I kind of ran along at first with the carriage, and then I lost my footing pretty soon, because it's amazing how much speed they pick up pulling out of the station. You don't realize until you're actually on the outside of it being pulled along. So I lost my footing, and then I was dragged along the platform, and then the train just kind of like felt like it was shifting through the gears very fast. And then next thing I knew, I was pulled between the gap of the platform edge and the actual train itself. So I went down, and I remember I heard this almighty rip at that point, and I remember looking up, and it's like the carriage doors and the edge of the carriage seemed to disappear up into the sky. You know, it was like a massive drop, it felt like. And then I thought, this is it. I'm going to die now. And I dropped into what could only be described as like, you know, sheer hell. It was just, I was thrown into darkness, and I was tossed around like a rug, and I was fully conscious throughout the whole thing. So, and then suddenly, from all this, this sort of frenzy of being bashed from side to side and all over the place and turned upside down, and I suddenly found myself between the track and the train itself was still continuing to go over my head at terrific speed. So I figured, right, it's not over yet, you know. A piece of the undercarriage could just come and hit me on the back of the head, and that would just finish me off. So, oddly enough, again, I was still in survival mode. I thought of, you know, Indiana Jones movies and sort of like James Bond 007. I just thought they
exactly right.
Down. Yes, exactly. And so that came into my head. And that's what I did. So I laid right down, and I remember my face being right in this oily gravel, and I just prayed for life. Well, I didn't pray at that point. I was just hoping that nothing was going to hit me. And thankfully, the train finally went on after what seemed like a lifetime, and then it disappeared off down the track and continued on. And there I was, lying there in complete agony. So, yeah.
You now, what is the extent of the damage to your body at this point?
Well, I looked to see what had happened, and the first thing I noticed that the left sleeve of my sheepskin coat was completely shredded, and I could see my arm, and I could see the inside of my arm exposed. And I hadn't realized at that point, but my left arm had been severed from the elbow down. So. And it's odd, but I was still thinking, right, I need to get my cell phone and call for help because I still thought that there was no one around, you know, to sort of come and rescue me. So I picked out the remnants of my cell phone, which were completely smashed. And but by that point, help had arrived because there was a hospital literally around the corner from the station itself. So the paramedics team arrived very, very, very fast, and the emergency guys jumped down. You know, it was quite a drop from the edge of the platform down to the track, but they all jumped down with a stretcher and started working on me. And it's an amazing thing. I mean, the first thing that entered my head obviously was like, I can't believe I'm alive. I can't believe I've survived it. And it was just, I remember looking at the sky. It was like a clear blue sky that day, and it just looked so beautiful. It's just like I really appreciated, you know, the earth surrounding me at that point, because it was just, you know, it was like an adrenaline rush to know that I was alive, I'd survived that. Because I thought, how did I survive? How did I?
Now, going through that, obviously you're telling us specific memories you have of James Bond, Indiana Jones, keeping your head low. Boy, if an undercarriage hits me. I mean, you've got all of this rattling around. Can you talk to me? And this may sound strange, so bear with me, David. But What was the concept of time for you during all of this? Was it bam, over? Or did it feel like meant nothing?
You're absolutely right. Well put. Yeah, time meant nothing. It was completely stretched out because it felt like from the moment I'd realized that my coat was trapped and the moment I went under the train, it felt like minutes, and it was actually seconds. Like, you know, the National Rail Police of the UK did a massive inquiry on it, and they could measure the whole thing by CCTV footage, and, you know, they measured everything up, and they said that, you know, from the moment the train pulled out, it took 7.5 seconds for me to go under. Now, for me to be able to, you know, have that, all those thought processes about how I'm going to survive this and sort of approach it with such ease is amazing, really. So apparently that happens. Apparently when people are facing near death, you know, that happens, that the mind slows down and it gives itself time to be able to process what's going on, that it's not this complete moment of frenzy that you expect, you know. In fact, I'd say that, you know, facing death itself, for me, it was terrifying, but it's nothing like you would expect something like that. It's you do actually, your rational brain does kind of kick in. Well, it certainly did for me anyhow. And I think that's what saved me, because interestingly enough, my friend Anna, who saw the whole thing unfold, you know, she told me she ran through the carriage and got to a window to see if I was okay as the train pulled out. And she said that afterwards, she said, you know, the odd thing is that when you went under, you seemed to roll under so gracefully. It's kind of like, she said, I hope you don't mind me telling you that. I said, no, because that's exactly what I intended. So there you go. It's just, I think that's what saved me physically, was, you know, this, having this kind of moment in time in my own mind to be able to process it and think it through.
Yeah, that's got to be an unusual moment, right? To just be kind of caught in this bubble of time where things are still happening, but you're kind of realizing them in a different speed than you would part of normal life.
Exactly. That's it. And
was there any other?
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, was there any other, if you look back at it now, were there any other weird aspects of this moment to you that stood out? Did you hear otherworldly voices, feel hands on you, or anything that might, you know, give you a depiction that you weren't really alone in this moment?
No, I didn't feel anything at all, to be honest with you. I mean, I was told later, I'd met a medium and got chatting to and she turned around to me, and she'd heard about the accident through the news, and she got chatting to me, and she said, you know that you were saved by a power animal that day when you had that accident. I was going, wow, that sounds fantastic, you know. And I said, I think I must have been, because The odd thing is, when I heard that almighty rip as I fell down, like I said, and I looked up at the carriage doors, I felt like it was me against the train. Suddenly turned into like this huge beast, you know, that was trying to kill me. And it was a real sort of like David and Goliath moment, if you like. I was just thinking, no, you're not going to take me. You're not going to kill me. So, I mean, I found out later and looked back spiritually in retrospect that I was definitely being helped and being guided. Otherwise, I wouldn't have survived. In fact, the head of the rail police of the UK concluded all their findings. And he turned around to me at the end and shook my hand. And he said, look, I've got to tell you that we're all shaking our heads here. He said, we did all our measurements, our mathematics, and you should be dead. There's no way you should have survived that. And we just don't get it. So I know now that it was that, yes, even though I didn't hear voices or feel anything at that sense, at that moment in time, that looking back on it, I do know that something was helping me.
All right. They are able to get you and collect you, rush you off to the hospital. What happens next?
Yeah, well, they finally got me into the back of an ambulance, and I remember the doctor turning around to me and said, look, there is a hospital around the corner, but there's one further away that's going to save you. Can you hang on? I said, yeah, let's go for it. And so I was still feeling like pretty sort of, you know, I wasn't panicking still at this stage. So I thought, let's do it. And we did. And we arrived in the hospital, and I remember being wheeled into the emergency department, and there was a whole team of medics and doctors waiting there for me. It was just kind of like, I remember seeing them, and it was just straight in, and there was a lot of frenzy. There was a lot of frantic voices, people running around, and, you know, all this sort of medical jargon floating over my head and stuff, and or rushing, I should say, over my head. And by that point, I was losing copious amounts of blood, I remember, but I was still kind of hanging in there, and the consultant who was looking after me, he was this amazing guy called Ian Grant, and he came over to me, and he was very calming, and he just said, look, your family have arrived, and you know, when we're ready, we could send, you know, some of them in to see you before you go into theatre, because we've got to take you straight through. And I said, yeah, sure. He said, how many can you see? I said, just send them all in. So, you know, I remember seeing my parents and my sister. And then the main person I was concerned about was my friend Anna, because, you know, she, as I said earlier, she'd had to watch this whole thing happen. And I just thought she must have believe that I hadn't survived that. It must have been horrific for her. So yeah, so anyway, so there I am, lying on and losing all this blood, and yeah, she came over to me, Anna, and because I asked for her, I said, I need to speak to Anna and check she's okay. So she came over to me. So even though I was like in this really awful state, all I could think about was that she was okay. And she was just shaking her head in complete disbelief, because she was going, I can't believe that you're here. I can't believe you survived that, you know. And she said, in fact, I thought you were dead, because when we got to the next station, they announced over the system that the hold ups because of being a fatality at the station. So, you know, poor girl, figured I was dead. Yeah.
And when she is standing before you talking to you about this, I mean, what, I'm sure you've spoken to her about it since and before, what was going through her mind? Did she tell you?
Well, what she told me was that, well, as I say, I think it was just complete disbelief that I'd survived. She told me this lovely story. She said that when the train stopped, it stopped in the middle of the country. Eventually, it took a while to stop it. She was running through the carriage trying to find a guard, and she did eventually. So they stopped the train, and she said that she was in tears, and she turned around to the people who were sat. It was a busy train, and she just said, look, do you mind if we say a prayer for my friend? And then a woman stepped forward and said, look, I'm a Christian. Would you like me to take the prayers? And she said, yeah, that'd be great. So
wow.
Anna said to me, the whole carriage just laid down their laptops and newspapers, you know, they're all commuters, and they all prayed. And she said it was like a really moving moment. So, so
I can only imagine, right?
Yeah, incredible. So,
you've had a chance to meet everybody, say possibly your goodbyes. I mean, is that a part of your mindset at this point that you're going to go in and you might not be coming out, or not at all?
Well, no. I mean, all I was thinking at that point was checking that everyone else was okay. It was mad, but I was apologizing to my mom because it was always, I said, it's always me getting in trouble, Mom, because it was, my life was all going along the wrong pathway before. And I just said, so is me causing all the drama. And she said, no, stop. You know, of course, he was crying and upset and, you know, but, you know, so I wasn't really thinking about myself or whether I was going to survive or whether I was going to die or anything. But it was the pain, the agony was really kicking in pretty bad. You know, I was in an awful lot of pain, and it just, there was a lot of intensity at that point because, you know, there's a lot of noise and overload, and just, I remember the lights were just very bright in my eyes. And then at that point, I left my body, and I left all that pain and the trauma, and I found myself in a much calmer place. So, yeah.
Just a miraculous moment all throughout. I mean, the people coming together for you, that you really, even though it was brutal what happened to you, that you survived with, you survived it all is remarkable. But that even with, and I don't want to say minimal issues, because obviously it wasn't minimal, but how it could have been, right?
It could have been a lot worse. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Right. Yeah.
So it's just astounding. You go in now, and next we're going to hear about what happens to you, this near-death experience, and we'll discuss that right after this.
From the creators of Cold Case Files and PD Stories comes the next great true crime podcast, I Survived. Every week, I Survived presents chilling first-person accounts from people who overcame deadly situations, allowing the survivors to describe the events as they unfolded and how they made it out alive. If you love true crime, you're going to love I Survived. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, PodcastOne.com, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps, so you can get new episodes every week.
David, don't leave us hanging. What is the next chapter in this story?
Okay, so as I was saying earlier, I suddenly gone from the frantic sort of frenzy of the hospital emergency department and the agony that I was in to what felt like a darkened space, but a really comforting darkened space, and I suddenly realized that I was no longer on the trolley or whatever, you know, in the hospital. I was laid on this huge kind of like piece of slate. It was like a big rock, like a sort of medieval altar almost, you know. And but it felt really comfortable, and I just laid there, and I looked around me, and I saw these pulsating colors. They were like orbs of colors, just kind of slowly pulsating all around me, like yellows, reds, and greens, and golds. And I felt really comforted by this. It was just a really calming effect. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And where am I? And then I looked up and down at my feet, and then at my feet I could see that there was this being of light. It was like an androgynous being, you know, and really beautiful glow to its skin, and with this kind of knowing smile expression on its face. And there was like this kind of, it had sort of like white blondish hair, but and wearing, which is odd, just wearing like a sort of a casual black t-shirt, you know, nothing, quite contemporary looking shirt, and very simple. And I just felt, I felt like I'd known this androgynous being like all my life and beyond. It was just like a soulmate, you know, like when you've just met somebody for the first time and you connect with them, you think, yeah, you know, I get you and you get me. But it was a lot stronger than that. And I figured at this point that I was dead. I thought, this is it. This is the next stage. I've moved on and I've died. But I got no fear whatsoever. I was really totally resigned to it and felt completely happy there. And thought, wow, so this is brilliant. This is where we go next. It's because the peace and the love that I was feeling from this being was just like pretty overwhelming. It was just really strong.
Now, were you seeing as though you were seeing through your eyes? And I know that might sound like a bizarre question, you know, because we think of ourselves in this physical form. Mm. Where you were obviously was not a physical place. What can you tell us regarding the sensations that you can remember from that?
Well, it seemed to me like I was, and it didn't seem like a vision at all. It was like I was there. You know, everything was very three-dimensional and or four-dimensional, if you like, because I was feeling the atmosphere of the place, and I was the sensation that was charging through my whole body, which was one of love. And, you know, I remember looking down at my body to see how the wounds looked, and all the wounds were completely healed. And I was just covered in like this blue sort of cloth. It was like a sort of blue sort of satin sheet, if you like. And it was like really calming. So again, it wasn't just something that I was looking at. I was feeling it. I was feeling the sensation of comfort from this this kind of blue satin sheet. So in saying that, it did feel like it was a different dimension. I knew that I wasn't here on Earth. I knew that I wasn't suddenly waking up from, you know, the anesthetic in a darkened room in the hospital. I knew that I was in a completely different sphere, altogether, you know, and it was, but it was very real. So,
The sensations that you're getting, this moment and this being that you're coming into contact with, do you remember, were you speaking? Was it speaking, or was this more of like a mind communication telepathically?
Yeah, it was telepathically, yeah. I mean, I do know that some people go through near-death experiences and they do say that they have conversations. But with me, it was all telepathic. And that telepathy continues to come through. It's a knowledge, basically. You just consume all this knowledge. And it's, for me, it was like very life-changing, the knowledge that I was gaining. A lot of it was just, well, it started to get stronger because as I laid my head back, I realized that there were two other beings suddenly appeared either side of me in female form. And they had their hands kind of like slowly hovering over my body. And I just lay back and felt this sensation of love that I was feeling from the first initial being that I'd see. But it was kind of starting to turn up like, you know, a lot more. It's like, because like the energy that was coming from their hands, it was almost like Reiki healing, if you like. It was just kind of going through I could feel every single sort of part of my whole body was kind of almost like sort of pulsating with this sensation of love, and it was really, really beautiful. So yeah, I just thought, this is like the most remarkable healing process that I could ever, I can't equate it to anything I've ever had in my life since.
Are you going through this with, you know, Are you excited? Are you sad because you're gone? Are you happy to just be there in that moment? You know, I mean, to us, or at least to me, it almost sounds like you've been abducted by aliens who are putting you back together. I mean, did it almost have that kind of strange sensation to it?
It did, yeah, it did. I didn't think I'd been abducted by aliens, but what I did think that this is the, you know, that this is death, that I died, and I was being prepared. I was being prepared for something, and I just felt that they were not really so much healing the physical wounds, but they were healing my soul. You know, it's just like healing all the hurt and the confusion that I carried throughout my whole life, basically, not just from the accident itself. And it's interesting because before I had this accident, as I said to you earlier, I carried a lot of guilt. I always felt like I was the one who was messing up in the family and bringing trouble home from being a young boy. And all that went, all my feelings of guilt and sort of beating myself up, if you like, emotionally, all that had gone. You know, it's like I totally forgave myself because I felt that the love coming from these three individual beings was forgiving me and telling me that, you know, I am loved. And so again, so it was all telepathy. I was experiencing all this, and it was interesting because I remember thinking to myself, I was lying down, I thought, oh, what about my family? You know, they're going to be down in the hospital now, looking down over what I figured would be my dead body. And just, I thought they're just going to be completely distraught. They've already been through enough as it is. And, but interestingly enough, I didn't go through the same kind of guilt trip that I would normally have done. You know, I just kind of figured, right, well, I'm just going to look over my left shoulder and look over the side of this huge rock that I'm lying on and see if I can see them. I don't know why, but I figured naturally that I'd be looking down. And, at that point, I looked slowly over my left-hand shoulder, hoping to see them all, but I didn't. I didn't see them. But what I did see was this remarkable sight. It was like this. It was like a beautiful, huge waterfall of stars, and these stars were like cascading down into other galaxies. And I kept looking down, and it was just like shooting stars disappearing into infinity. And I thought, wow, you know, of course, I'm not in a small darkened room at all. I'm actually in the universe itself. You know, it's just, I'm just literally out in the universe. And it was a very overwhelming but exciting vision, you know. So yeah, in answer to your question, I had no feeling of regret that I passed over. I was just very excited by it all. And I realized that the afterlife is actually a really beautiful sort of, you know, almost like coming home to your, I felt like I was at home. I felt like I'd known myself for the first time in my whole life. And I felt like I'd forgiven myself for the first time in my whole life also.
So aside from just physical healing, you were totally getting an emotional and spiritual recharging as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was the main thing really. Yeah.
Were you experiencing the, you know, kind of quintessential life review or visitations from loved ones, family, recognizable people? What can you tell us about that?
Right. No, I didn't actually have those experiences. A lot of that came afterwards, actually, funny enough, which I can explain to you as we go on. But each near-death experience is obviously different for each person. And obviously, I want to be as authentic to the whole story as I can be, and explain to you that that didn't happen. I didn't have a life review. I mean, I'm not saying I was a saint throughout my whole life, but I don't think that. I think if I was really, what I did realize while I was lying there and going through this experience was that the only person really that I owed anything back to was myself. You know, as I say, I'm not trying to be a saint, but I didn't really, even when I was down on my luck, I don't really feel that I dragged other people through or put other people through. hard times because of my own sufferings, as it were. And I think when people do have life reviews, it's usually, this is my, from the research that I've done since, it's normally because, you know, they put people through discomfort or you know, haven't been too good to others because of their own shortcomings, you know. So, so I didn't have a life review, no.
All right. So once you've kind of adapted to this sense and this healing that you're getting, what happens to you next?
Well, what happened next was that I was just suddenly had the sensation of this. I remember looking up, the three grids of light had appeared above my head. And so I was looking into those lights. And it's interesting because they were so bright and so pure that I couldn't take my gaze away from them. And it's not like, you know, if you look into the sun, obviously, or you look into electric light, you can't do it. You know, your eyes can't handle it. Whereas this light, I could. And I just didn't want to take my gaze away because it was just so pure and beautiful. And so I just lay back captivated by this light. And then as I looked down again, excuse me, at my feet, I suddenly realized there was an energy force that was turning up like tenfold, if you like. It was this energy was like coming towards me, and I thought, what is that? And I looked, and there was like this huge tunnel of light that was just slowly making its way towards me, or I was making its way towards it. And this tunnel of white light, again, was this purity of white light in the middle. And it was surrounded by these kind of like slowly rotating flames of yellows, reds, and oranges. And very powerful, very, very powerful flames. But at the same time, not at all frightening. You know, if you see that amount of fire on Earth, it's kind of like, whoa, this is danger. Whereas I didn't feel danger from all this. It just felt like really safe. And this energy just kind of like completely was, I felt every molecule of my body by now was just kind of like almost shaking with this sensation of life and love. It was just tremendous. And I just, again, it was all telepathy, that I just knew that this energy was the source of all creation. You know, this to me, this was God. I was staring at God and I was feeling God. And not this guy up in the sky with the long beard, you know, putting his hand down to us all. This was literally, you know, this tunnel of white light. But this was, to me, that was the source of all creation. And I just remember looking at that and thinking, I'd found the answer at that point. And then as I found that answer, I remember putting my head back and smiling and almost laughing at the same time with joy. And next thing I knew, I'd come crashing back down to Earth, and I was in the hospital and lying there in agony, just and all the pain came rushing straight through back through my body. And you know, the light, the pure white light that was in my eyes before, that was beautiful to look at, was now replaced by, you know, fluorescent strip. It was just screaming into my eyes, you know. And yeah, there I was, back on Earth.
Was there, how did that feel to be back, released from where you'd just been, this place of peace and contentment and healing, to be thrust back into the real world, this world, and the pain and what you had to go through?
Funnily enough, I mean, obviously, the agony was all there when I came back, and I was, you know, and there was momentarily sad that I hadn't stayed where I was, but I also momentarily knew that I'd been there for a reason, and that I'd got something to tell. And I remember at that point, my friend Anna again stepped forward, and she came over to me because they were just about to wheel me into theater to start operating on me. And so she came over just to sort of hold my hand and say goodbye. And I just said, Anna, I've got something really important to tell you. And she said, not now, just tell me later. I said, no, I've got to tell you now. This is so important. And she said, and she just put her hand gently over my mouth. And you know, she obviously thought I was just in shock or whatever at that point. So yeah, by then, you know, I'd hardly had time to really even sort of digest it all because I was straight into theater and I was under anesthetic for 7.5 hours.
Now, how long was that whole period that they lost you?
The actual near-death experience itself?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, was it the near-death experience people are used to where it's, you know, boom, you flatline and this takes place in that span of time? Or was this just your consciousness had left, your soul had left while your body was still functioning?
Yeah. My body was still functioning, so I didn't flatline. But again, looking into my research, this is quite normal as well. A lot of, you know, it's called near-death experience, but you don't, not everyone flatlines, you know. It really is a point where you're going, you've just been through incredible trauma like myself and you know, as in my case, losing copious amounts of blood, which was life-threatening. So it's normally life-threatening situations, but I didn't actually flatline. So there's no record at all of how long I was gone, you know, from an Earth point of view, if you like. But so it's really hard to tell because it's that phrase you came out with earlier was really great. You know, the essence of time and stuff. You know, and I can't really say how long I was gone for. So I'm not really sure.
Did it feel like it was an afternoon away at a spa kind of sensation?
No.
Like you were gone for a month?
It didn't feel like that long at all. No, nothing like that. It felt like pretty much the amount of time that I've just pretty much explained it to you, really. I figured, you know, that was I learned what I needed to learn while I was there, and they sent me back for a reason. You know, I would have been quite happy to have stayed. I really would. But I knew when I woke up in hospital after the operation that there was a reason that had all happened. And I didn't know what it was. I was desperate to find out an answer as to I thought, why have they sent me back? Why did they save me? So, yeah. That was
all right.
Question.
Let's do this. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll find out from our guest what happens next. What, in his opinion, indisputable proof was he able to reclaim from the afterlife that he's able to bring back and share with us now? Stay tuned. We've got more coming your way. I'm Dave Schrader. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.
Do you experience stress or have anxiety or even chronic pain or have trouble sleeping at least once a week? Well, you're not alone. Many of us do. And personally, I know I do. You know, I told you about it last week. 13 herniated discs. All the way from C2 to L5 S1. I'm herniated all the way up and down my back and neck. I've got knee pain. I've got ankle pain. I had my leg bone go all the way through my ankle and my foot. I could sit and complain to you for probably half an hour, but we don't have that kind of time. I got a lot of pain. I was searching for something that would help, and I discovered Feels. What is Feels, you may ask? Well, Feels is premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep. And what does Feels do? Well, Feels naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. The condition I have, plain and simple, is extreme chronic pain. Pain and trouble sleeping. I even have some anxiety from that chronic pain. If you've ever been in such chronic pain, and I know I'm talking to somebody out there right now who has such pain that if you've ever gone through a day where your pain level is a 3 and you feel like something's wrong because you have a lack of pain, then you know what I'm talking about. That it's unusual for you to be in a state where you're not in extreme pain. I'll tell you, with chronic pain comes anxiety. There is some anxiety. And I don't want to talk to you for just a brief moment about anxiety with chronic pain. There's the anxiety that if that pain goes away, something bad will happen. Or if that pain gets any higher, that you'll break down or you'll lose control, or you'll lose it, period. Or that you'll lose your mind. I've had days like that too. I've had days where I've been curled up on the couch or curled up in bed, not being able to get out of bed. Maybe curl up all day because I've been in such extreme pain that I can't move. And I feel trapped within my own body. And with that comes anxiety. Sometimes you need something that treats the pain and treats the anxiety at the same time. CBD does that, and Feels does that as well. It also helps me when I need to sleep, because let's face it, opioids don't do all that as well. Opioids are dangerous. Let's face it, opioids are dangerous. I've worked myself off of Vicodin. I'm working myself right now off of MS-Con, morphine. It's dangerous stuff. Feels helps you reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. It's been a huge help to me, a huge help. And it really does get into your system, and it reduces inflammation. How do you take it? Well, you just place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and feel the difference within minutes. I'll tell you, when I first got mine, it was very simple. It comes with instructions and tells you exactly how much you need to use, how much you put underneath your tongue, how much you put in that dropper. Bang, you put it under your tongue. You let it sit there for about 30 seconds. Swallow it right down. And within minutes, you start to feel the difference. You start to feel human again. You start to feel that pain subside. You start to, like the Tin Man, when he puts the oil can to his joints, you start to feel yourself release a little bit and start to feel that creakiness go away. If you're new to CBD and you don't have someone around that you can talk to about it, Feels offers a free CBD hotline and text message support to help guide your personal experience, which is important because, let's face it, sometimes when you're treading in uncharted waters, you don't feel comfortable using something the first time, and Feels knows that, so they're there for you, which is great, because I'll tell you, I had questions when I first started using it myself. You can feel better naturally. Feels works naturally to help you feel better. There's no high, there's no hangover, there's no addiction. I know what happens when you start taking CBD. Of course, your family chides you, your friends chide you. Oh, dude, you're getting high, man. You're using the junk, dude. You're hooked, man. That's not what it is. Feels is completely natural CBD. Feels is all natural. No high, no hangover, no addiction, all natural pain relief. And it's absolutely perfect for you to use. Perfectly legal. Join the Feels community to get Feels delivered to your door every month. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel at any time. There's no pressure for you to continue with Feels, but I'll guarantee you, once you start using CBD and once you start using Feels, you're going to want to continue because you start feeling great. The joints start loosening up and you stop feeling stiff and you start feeling pain and that anxiety starts to subside. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/darkness. And I tell you what, you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping, which is amazing. That's F as in Frank, E-A-L-S as in Sam.com/darkness to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. I tell you what, go there right now, cut that pain, get that anxiety out of the way, start to sleep, start to get some sleep finally, get some relief from that pain and anxiety. Join the Feels community right now. Get a discount right now off your first order. 50% off your first order with free shipping. Do it right now. Go to feels.com/darkness today.
The music you're hearing right now comes into play as this story unfolds. It's music that was composed by our guest, David Ditchfield. His book, Shine On, The Remarkable Story of How I Fell Under a Speeding Train, Journey to the Afterlife, and the Astonishing Proof I Brought Back With Me, will be out on July 1st, 2020. We have a link up so you can pre-order the book right now. Go in, take advantage of it. The link is on today's program. All right, David, you have gone through something traumatic. You go in now for this 7.5-hour surgery. What's it like when you come back out of this?
Right. Well, I come out of it, and I'm going through two sort of things here. And one is I'm obviously physically facing up to what had just happened to me. You know, I was in a lot of pain coming through, and I was suffering from, you know, still heavy from the anesthetic. So I was feeling pretty lousy. But inside my soul, inside me, I got this kind of like burning energy. You know, I was still, it's almost like I was still connected to the other side. Like I was, the part of me was still there, and I was still excited by everything that had happened. And I was still feeling this kind of really strong sensation of love that I'd experienced. And I just thought, I remember just, I was in this, the hospital had given me this room to myself, obviously at first, because they didn't want to put me on a ward. But so I was in that room on my own for quite some time throughout the night, I remember. So I got lots of time to like really think it all through. And as I said earlier, I was just figuring, what is my purpose? What is my sole purpose now? And I was not the same person that I had been before I'd been under that train. And I knew that my life had completely changed, and that I viewed myself in a completely different way.
Now, it's interesting that you say that. You knew that you weren't the same person.
Mm.
Okay. I'd like to examine that as this story unfolds. But when you come back, obviously this is a life-changing, life-affirming, afterlife-affirming experience, something that, you know, I know there are many people, oh boy, I wish I could have a feeling like that. I'm sure the trade-off is probably not great, folks. You don't want to get to that point of death.
No.
To have experience. So we're lucky enough today to have our guide, David Ditchfield, walk us through this experience. But when you began healing and were coming through this, what was some of the first inklings that your life was changed in more than just a spiritual journey kind of way and an awakening?
Well, I just had this burning desire to sort of try and record what had happened to me and tell the world basically about it. So I had this idea in my head that I wanted to paint like what had happened, but not just a small painting. I wanted to do like a big canvas, you know, like a big Renaissance style canvas, which is nothing like I'd never done anything like that before in my life. I remember my sister coming in on the very first night to see me, you know, and she was talking to me quietly. And just before she left, she said, is there anything I can get you? And I said, yeah, can you get me a small pad with a pencil and an eraser? And a sharpener, you know. And she said, okay, looking very puzzled. But she brought that in, and I remember I got the nurses to kind of prop me up because I could not move at all. You know, I was unable to move. I was in so much pain. But they managed to prop me up, and I did this very faint sketch of the afterlife that I'd seen that I was intending to paint. And, you know, that was my goal. I thought, I'm going to paint this as soon as I get out of hospital. But not only that, it's just my family and friends around me who came to visit me, you know, they saw this change in me as well. You know, people were coming in saying, you're just glowing. You're just, you know, one of my friends said, you just look so animated. I was expecting to come up and see you from London and seeing this, you know, I was expecting the worst. But yes, you're in a bad way physically, but you just have this absolute presence of positivity about you. And I was just giving this positivity out to everyone around me. In fact, my mum said that. She said, it's strange because it's almost like you're healing other people around you. You're giving out your sort of strength to others, and where they're supposed to be looking after you. So this is very out of character for me to be in this way. So that was one of the big changes I noticed in myself, that I was loving myself a lot more. So I was able to give something back to others, I guess.
That's a nice change, right? And you've got this now. Obviously, you're in a banged up condition. And just to give our audience a full perspective, exactly what parts of your body were damaged and what kind of healing were you going through physically?
Well, remarkably, the left arm being severed was actually the worst part of the injury. The whole of my body took a complete beating because, as I said earlier, I was just, you know, completely tossed around from pillar to post or whatever, you know, as I was thrown underneath that train. And so every single part of me was aching and bruised, and but hardly anything else, which is still strange because, you know, again, you know, the everyone was really surprised that I didn't receive more injuries than that. You know, they when the consultant was waiting for me in the hospital, he said that they got a call, you know, from the station, so they were expecting far worse than what they got. So it was a miracle that that nothing worse happened to me. But in saying that, it took me a long time to recover, you know. But, you know, I got there.
Now, as you're going through this physical recovery, are you noticing any other strange changes in your life?
Just this burning desire to find out why this had happened to me. And why was I sent back? You know, initially I thought it was to help other people because that's obviously the first thing that would enter your mind, isn't it? So I remember being on the ward, and once I was able to start, they got me on my feet and got me walking up and down the ward. And I remember there was older people on the ward who were really unhappy to be in hospital. And I used to go to their bedsides and talk to them. One guy I knew that he was actually dying. He was 91. And he was refusing a blood transfusion due to his faith. And so I knew he was going to go. So I remember talking about what had happened to me. And so he was the first person really that I was trying to help through, you know. And I figured this was what my life's quest was. But as time went on, I realized that wasn't really what it was all about. I mean, I was going to be telling other people about what I'd experienced on the other side, but it was going to be through painting and then through music. I started to realize that I was developing new skills and gifts, first of all as an artist. You know,
so had you been an artist in the past?
No, I mean, I'd always enjoyed, you know, drawing and sketching when I was younger, but because of my lack of qualifications from school, I didn't carry it forward. But I'd never done anything at all on the scale that I'm doing now. You know, I mean, people turn around to me and say, it's really ambitious just to attempt the kind of size of canvases that I went for straight away. And I felt that when I first started my very first painting, I was very sort of like apprehensive because I thought, can I do this? Can I pull it off? But as soon as I started painting, the paint that was going on the canvas, the ideas that were coming out and the skills felt like it wasn't just me doing it. And I realized that at that point that I was getting help, that this was coming through from the other side. You know, I'd never lost at all that sensation that I was still attached to this remarkable place that I'd been to. And as I say, the telepathy that was coming through from them was continuing to come through. I was still being taught how to paint and how to express the love that I'd felt on the other side through my paintings.
And this art, this expression that you were creating, was it different in a lot of ways from what you had always been able to do before?
Oh yes, totally. You know, I was suddenly feeling like I'd found myself. You know, as I said to you before, when I was picking up the kind of manual work that I could find, that I just wasn't that good at it. So it was a struggle for me to keep jobs because I was just too slow. You know, I was just not really you know, I looked around at these guys. I thought, wow, they're really skilled at what they're doing. And I just couldn't get that skill. Whereas suddenly I found my skill. I'd found that I was an artist and I was painting and I was comfortably in my own shoes for the first time in my life. It was just a euphoric moment, you know, to discover that. But it all felt new. It all felt like, and it's still to this day, every single painting that I do, I know that I'm channeling ideas through from somewhere else, that it's not all me doing these paintings, because the paintings that I'm doing, they're being done for a reason, because it's my way of offering a window into the afterlife for people to be able to see what I experienced and went through. So,
how do people respond to the artwork when they see it?
Well, generally speaking, everybody's very moved by it. I mean, initially what happened was a friend of my sister's, her and her husband, they run like a health center. And I bumped into, she came around to visit and she said, "How's that painting going?" And of course, as I said earlier, I was reluctant to start it. And I said, "Well, I must start it, but I can't do it here. There's not enough room," because I was staying at my sister's to recover. And her and her husband had set up a room for me there. So I was making excuses not to start. And she said, "Well, look, we've got like a room, a studio, and in our yoga studio that's spare for a week. Why don't you come? It's up in the attic and you can use it." And I went, okay, so I got no excuse. So I went there and I started painting. And I got to the end of that week and there's no way I was going to finish it. And she said, "Oh, you can carry on. Don't worry. We'll work around you. We want you to stay and do this." So I did do, and I ended up staying for 2 years. They were fantastic. You know, I know, it was brilliant. So they said it's just great having you around, because people were coming in to the classes and word got around that, you know, what was going on. I mean, everybody knew about my accident because it was all over the local newspapers and stuff, you know, that this guy had gone under a train and survived it. So people knew about it. So they were interested. And a lot of people were coming up, and that's when I realized that people were very moved by it and were asking me questions and wanted to know, "So what's this? So what's that there?" And I was describing it straight away. I said, "Well, that's the tunnel of light I saw. That's the androgynous being," you know, and people were immediately fascinated. It's great, because right at the beginning, when I came through from the anesthetic, I just thought, how am I going to tell this to people? Are people going to believe this? Are they going to think, yeah, okay, you know? But generally speaking, you know, people want to know. People want to hear, because I realize now that none of us really talk about death. We're all going to face it. It's going to happen to us all, you know, and we just don't discuss it. So I figure that from my point of view, as soon as I start showing my artwork to people, it's a very kind of gentle way of saying, well, you know, this is what happens. This is the afterlife, you know. And it's like, I'm not trying to, I mean, one thing I make sure that I don't try and sort of push this story like it's, yeah, you've got to listen to this. This is my story. You know, it's if people want to hear it, that's great. But, you know, so yeah, but so everyone so far, I find that I've shown it to have been moved by it. Even people who've got a very scientific approach are still fascinated by it. Yeah.
Now, talk to us about the music. We played some of the music coming out of the bit earlier today. What this musical aspect of you, was this something new?
Right. Okay. Again, this kind of music is totally new to me. I mean, I've been a guitarist when I was living in London. You know, I was when I say a guitarist, I was like, you know, I was playing like a sort of like punk rock, sort of rock and roll, three chord wonder songs. And so it was all very basic stuff, but, you know, which I enjoyed. But obviously, I never made a living out of that, because it's not everybody does. There's only a few who managed to sort of break through and cut it, but I didn't. But so that was my only tools of music, really. And what had happened was when I was recovering from my ordeal, I wanted to find this spiritualist church, because I also wanted to try and find like-minded souls I was hoping that I could talk to, that I could share the experience with, you know. Because when I was in hospital, I remember asking to speak to the priest, you know, the hospital priest, to talk to him about it. And he was a lovely guy, but I just really didn't feel like it was kind of he was connecting with what I said. So I come across this spiritualist church. This is a couple of months prior to my accident. Again, I was on the train coming up to visit my sister and her family, and I bumped into this this elderly couple who sat opposite me, and they were asking where the next station was, you know, where the train was going. So I told them, and then this lady said to me, "Look, where are you getting off at the next station?" I said, "Yes, I am." She said, "Well, we're going to see a medium tonight, and she's really good. Why don't you come along?" And I, as I said to you earlier, yeah, I've got no interest in anything like that at all. So, she gave me a flyer, like a small poster, and said, you know, take this with you. So I did. So I got to my sister's house, and there was a lot going on when I'd arrived. And I think she got friends over and stuff. So I figured, maybe I'm just going to go to the local bar and have a drink while they were sorting themselves out, which I did. And I had this flyer with me. And I looked at it and I thought, you know what, I'm going to go. I'm just going to go and check this out. I've never been to anything like this before, so let's go and have a look. So it was in this little spiritualist church in the town, and it was packed. And I remember this medium came out, and she was pacing backwards and forwards. And people were there basically looking for messages, you know, from their loved ones who passed on. And she would say, oh, you know, I'm picking up your grandfather's clock and stuff like this. You know, did he wear a watch? And, yes, that's him, you know. So, and I wasn't looking for any messages whatsoever. But she did stop at one point, and she looked round at me and said, gentleman over there in the blue top, your life is about to change. And I went, oh, great. You know, I said, in what way? And she stopped, she said, they're not telling me. They just said, be prepared because it's going to be big. And she said, but you will be helped. And I thought, oh, great, thanks. And I thought, you know, I'm going to win the lottery. I'm going to, you know, the relationship I was chasing to was going to all come together and all things like that. But that wasn't to be. It was basically, she was talking about this whole accident, basically, and the near-death experience, because nothing else had happened in between. So I was really keen to find this place. And when I just stumbled across it, my sister used to take me out for walks in the town once I was ready to start walking around, and we just walked past it. We were walking by the river. I said, there it is. There's the doorway to that place. So I went in. And when I walked through the door, we got chatting, and I was offered spiritual healing. They said, we do spiritual healing here on Thursday nights. Would you like to come along? And I said, I'd love to. And so I went. And this was after the accident, obviously, I'm talking. And now this is winding forward to the future. And so while I was in these healing sessions, some of the healers were clairvoyant. And they give you, like, you know, just short messages at the end. And week after week, they started saying, they're telling me you're going to write music about your experience. So I figured, okay, I'm going to, you know, going to write a 3-chord wonder song, but I can't play guitar anymore because of my injury. How am I going to do this? So I pulled out this little old synthesizer out of the cupboard that I got, that I bought up from London, and it was like an old cheap Spanish thing. And but it was great, you know. And I plugged it in, and I was playing around, and this little chord progression came through. And I thought, that sounds lovely. I like that. So I recorded it onto cassette. That's all I got at that point. Came back, listened to it again after I'd made a coffee, and I thought, no, that's really lovely. So I developed it up, and I just thought, this is something that could be played by orchestra. And this is, again, it's the same feeling as when I was in hospital. I was ambitious. I thought, I didn't think twice about it. You know, I thought, no, an orchestra needs to perform this. So
you thought these outlets were divine kind of gifts that were unleashed you, suddenly having the ability to write these orchestral movements and create these paintings and be able to effectively show your story. This was something that you had brought back with you that wasn't really a part of who you were before this near-death experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was totally divinely guided with both aspects, but also guided by things falling into place for me. For example, when I was doing the paintings at that studio, one of the people who was coming for the yoga classes was a cellist in the local orchestra. And she kept coming up, and she was loving what was going on. And she said, can we use one of your paintings for our next poster? I said, of course, yeah. So we got to be friends, and she said, how's it going? And we should meet for coffees in the end. And I said, look, I told her about the new piece of work. I was working on this music, and I said it came through from spiritual healing. She went, oh, wow. I said, yeah. I said it feels like it should be played by an orchestra rather than played in a rock band, you know. And she said, maybe we could do it in our orchestra. So I thought, I'm going to hold you to that. And I thought, I'm going to find a way to get this done. Now, my brother stepped in at that point, and he said, look, I've got this this computer app that I can give you, and I'm going to set you up. So he bought up an old laptop that he wasn't using anymore, and he let me have it. And I basically use this app. He said, what happens is you play those chords that you've been working on and all the different parts on your synthesizer and play it into this app, and it will transpose it into basic notation form. So that's what I did. And then I just got it to the stage where I got some music scored for the first opening bars of my new piece, and told the cellist I'd got that far, and she said, okay, we'll meet for coffee with the leader of the orchestra. So they met me. They looked at the score and they went, yeah, this is really good. We'll do it. So I was only like a third of the way through at that point, and they'd agreed to perform it. So it all started just coming together piece by piece, and I was channeling all these ideas through, and they were helping me to hear sounds. I was hearing instruments that I didn't know what they were, you know, like I was hearing like a horn sound, which I now know is a French horn, and you know, trumpets and violins and violas and stuff. And I was slowly building it up and getting some help, obviously, you know, you do need some kind of practical physical help to be able to pull all this off and stuff. When I say that, I needed to know what kind of instruments were really needed I needed to know all the instruments that were in that orchestra that made them up, you know,
this music just kind of, you know, pour out of you as though it was coming to you from someplace else.
Yes, it did. It absolutely did. And it was just like, it was so exciting. I could feel that this was energy coming through from the other side. This was my expression of everything that I felt. All that love I talked about earlier, that, you know, unconditional love that was on the other side, was all coming through. And all the emotions. I mean, the piece, which is called The Divine Light, is basically, it's three movements altogether, and all three movements take you through the journey from the start to the finish of the whole near-death experience. So as it was all coming together, it was almost like it was helping me to reenact everything that had happened in music form. And, you know, I'd sit back and I'd think, wow. I mean, there was one point I just thought the final part, the final movement, I thought that needs somebody to sing it. That needs a vocal. So again, I was guided because I went to see this guy called Julian Merson, who's like one of the best sort of male tenors in Cambridgeshire. And I thought, I'm just going to go straight to the top and speak to him and see if he can recommend somebody who might sing it for me. And again, he looked at the score and he said, I like this. I like these chords, because I'd written unusual chords that weren't usual because I wasn't educated. You know, he says, I like the fact that you put a C sharp with a C major, that you wouldn't normally see that, but it's good. And, you know, things like that. And he turned around and he said, you know what, I'll do it. And I went, really? He said, yeah. So he offered to sing it. And again, the lyrics came through. I remember the lyrics came. I'd gone to my sister had rented out this little place, like a beach hut, a house, I should say, and right on the coast. And when we arrived that night, I'd read in the paper that there was going to be like a meteor shower. And I remember seeing this meteor shower. I stayed up through the night and watched it, sat on the sand dunes. And then that inspired me. I woke up the next day and I wrote all the lyrics. And those lyrics, again, they were divinely sort of guided. You know, when I read them now, I think they're not me. They're not my kind of lyrics at all, you know, but they basically express everything that I was going through.
You said that you felt like you had changed. And in this aspect, do you feel like, you know, we've heard of things called soul walk-ins, where it's as though another soul has entered the vessel of your physical being and continued this life. Do you feel that that might be part of who you are, that really the reason you feel like a new man is because part of you is that maybe the soul that once resided there is no longer and this is something entirely new?
No, I feel like it's still the same soul that's been with me throughout my whole life, but I just feel like it's been healed now, and I feel like it's been forgiven, you know, and it's been loved, you know, by myself, basically. It's just the main lesson I've learned from all this is just to give myself some love and to be authentic to myself. I wasn't being authentic to myself before, you know. I was just, because I, as I said, left school without any qualifications, I was always trying to sort of cover up for myself by being what I thought I should be in front of other people. But now I'm just totally authentic to myself, and it gives myself a chance to shine through, really with where I'm at, so in my life. And I mean, I do, when I'm working, when I'm creating music and when I'm creating, art, or even talking to you now about the near death experience, I do feel like, yes, that I'm channeling, as I call it, channeling other souls or other dimensions through me, coming from somewhere else. So it's not me as I'm talking to you now, just sat here. There's more going on, and there's more. And I basically, when I sit back and I look at my work and I look at it, I think, yeah, I've been guided there. I always look up and say thank you. You know, I just send out my thanks, because it's just fantastic that it's continuing on. It feels like it's something that's got to get out there. You know what I mean? You know, the next stage of the game was to, as you said earlier, was to write a book and get a book out there, which is, again, was crazy because I'm dyslexic. And, you know, there's no way I would ever imagine that I would be writing my first book. But it had to be done.
For skeptics that are listening, right, to say, you know, this is kind of unequivocal proof of the afterlife, having kind of a broader spectrum to your musical and artistic abilities, one could say, well, listen, you were limited because of the damage that was done to you. You had to become more creative, which you already were to begin with. And this found a way, like being robbed of your hearing. Sometimes the eyesight becomes stronger. How do you know that? I mean, how do we look at this as real proof of the the afterlife and your experience, simply because you're able to channel your creative presence into something a little, you know, more profound than you perhaps had before?
Well, basically from my own perspective, as I said to you, I was very keen once I got out of hospital to look into it and research into it. That's how seriously I took it. Once I started reading up on other people and realizing that it was a near-death experience and that so many others were very similar, especially over the last year since I've been doing interviews, I've actually been interviewed by people who've had near-death experiences themselves. And we share so much, you know, there's so much, it's not confirmation. You're not looking for confirmation, but it's affirmation. You go, yes, I felt that too. Yeah, I saw that. And so many different things and lots of similarities that you realize that it's there, it's for real, you know. It's like, I lost my mother sadly last summer, and it was heartbreaking. Thank you. It was heartbreaking for me to lose my mom physically, and the mother who raised me, and missing her being around. But again, it was just, it helped me so much with my inner strength, because I knew where she was going. I knew exactly the moment she passed, the place she was in, the place that I'd just been. I knew that she'd be there and how much she would love it. And so it's kind of like, for me, it's like really, you know, It's not. I've never questioned it, and it's never sort of faded. It's never become a lack of interest to me. If anything, it becomes more of an interest in it. And I'm constantly learning. As I said to you, I didn't have the life review, and I didn't speak to people on loved ones on the other side. But I realize as time goes on that they are with me, and I'm feeling that I'm constantly learning through that thought process that comes through. Yeah, going back to what you said earlier, yes, I agree with you. I want to try and say to other people, I'm not trying to say, look, you've got to have a near-death experience to be where I'm at now. Actually, quite the opposite. What I'm trying to say to people is learn to look at me, look at where I was at, and how I was just basically end-gaining and not really giving myself a break or giving myself any love. And that's all you've got to do, just stop and be authentic. You know, don't try to put on an act and be real with yourself and with others. And it's just, I'm not preaching it again. As I say to you, I don't go around preaching this stuff. It's just, I talk about it when people want to hear about it. And I just hope that it gives people some kind of guidance, basically, to sort of give themselves that self-worth. And also not to fear death. A lot of people fear death, and they fear that once their loved ones have passed on, that they've just, the light switched off, and that's really awful. What an awful feeling to know, to feel that your loved one's just gone and that's it. But to realize that that's not the case is a massive thing, and I'd love to be able to tell as many people that as possible. So I'm not trying to say, hey, look at me, I went to the afterlife, it's amazing, you know, I'm this incredible being, because I'm not. So I'm not saying that.
No, I get that aspect. I just, you know, I mean, people want to feel like there's something that they're able to connect with. And obviously you're doing it in your storytelling, in your art, and in your music, kind of sharing different levels of the experience. Have you ever considered creating maybe even a book with a soundtrack to it that tells your story in an artistic way?
No, that's a good point. And by the way, I wasn't suggesting that you were saying that at all, Dave. I was just, No, I know you get where I'm coming from. So, I haven't thought about that idea. I'm constantly sort of, looking for ideas and ways of getting the story across as in, you know, people turn around to me and say, oh, this would make a really good movie, you know, and, because, you know, and if it were, that would be great, you know, because whatever medium it takes to get the story across to people, I don't care. That'd be great, you know, because I've never read a book in my life. So there you go, because of my dyslexia. So for me, if I was coming along and I just met me for the first time, I'd be going, oh yeah, that'd be a brilliant idea.
Interesting to almost dumb it down, and I don't mean that as any slight to our audience or to broader audiences, but you've put together this beautiful artwork representing your story, almost like a children's book. You could write this with short blurbs about the journey and what it taught you. I just think, you know, marrying those three things together with even the music that you've created might be an interesting aspect when you might see that these mediums blend well together. Your writing, your art, and your music can come together and create one narrative and give people kind of, like you said, you had a much more fulfilling, enriching experience, and it was no one detail, but it was all the details together that really changed who you are as a person.
Yeah. No, that's true. I mean, one thing I do actually is I put together the what I call video diaries, which I put on my website and on my Facebook page and what have you, on social media. And for me, that's another way of just kind of like giving a different dimension to it all, you know, is that they're just short video diaries, which I feel are just kind of like, it's okay to wake up and have your morning coffee and watch something that's only like about, you know, 5 minutes long, if that, less than that, you know. So it's I'm always looking for different ways of trying to get the story across. And yeah, so that sounds great. That's a brilliant idea you just suggested there. So I'll let you know if I pull that one off.
75% of it. Yeah, just 75%. Yeah, I'm not a greedy man. What would you tell people that have a fear of death and what comes next? You know, if push came to shove, what would your answer be?
Well, I've already been asked that by a few people, actually. In fact, I did a film just recently with, I don't know if you're familiar with it, there's a newspaper here called The Guardian in the UK. And they also have like a, you know, like a sort of an internet page as well, a web page. And so I was talking to this young journalist called Leah Green, and she's actually got a very firm fear of death. So she put together like a series of films, you know, talking to people who were terminally ill and stuff like that. And so I was suggested to her. So she came and filmed me here, and we stood on the platform, you know, in the station. And she was more terrified than I was. She actually pointed it out. She said, every time a train goes through, I'm jumping out of my skin, you know, and you're not, kind of thing. But as I pointed out, it took me a lot of therapy to also get to that point. But that's another story. But there's nothing to fear. Nothing to fear. And, you know, that death is not the end. It's the next stage of the journey. You know, to me, it's kind of like our souls are too big. You know, to suddenly just switch off like a light. And yeah, okay, I think, you know, our bodies, yeah, they naturally die. But our souls continue on, and I don't think there's. We should just kind of be thinking that we're only here just for this stage of the journey, and then it's all over. It continues. That's what I would say to people.
Very cool. Well, David, thank you for sharing your journey. Shine on, the remarkable story of how I fell under a speeding train, journey to the afterlife, and the astonishing proof I brought back with me. It's an amazing story. We've got a link up so you can hear more of David's music, find his art and his book. We also have a link to the book so you can pre-order it right now. Don't wait. Go get that pre-ordered so that as soon as it comes out, you've got it. Again, we've just scratched the surface. This is a glossary version of the deeper tale that is David's story. David, thank you again for being with us and sharing this story.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. And hey, folks, come on out. See Tim and I. We're going to be at Phenomenology 2020. This is a premier exclusive paranormal event, March 26th through the 29th in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There are a lot of great guests, Jason Hawes, Johnny Zaffis, Chris Fleming, Andrea, and Roger Perrin, the father-daughter team from The Conjuring, the real story of The Conjuring. There is Jeff Belanger, Stacey Jones, the ghost cop, Deanna Simpson, who you heard featured on our show, Tim Dennis, that guy's going to be there, Eric Altman, our Monster Watch specialist, and so many other great speakers are going to be on hand. It's a great opportunity for you to come out, meet people, get some autographs, get the chance to shake hands, do a little investigating, and get to hear from your favorites. Again, Phenomenology. Oh, by the way, I'll be there. Shane Pittman will be there from the Holzer Files. Both of us will be on hand. We'll be talking about the Holzer Files. Again, tickets are at phenom2020.com. Phenom 2020.com. You can always go check out darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com, and find the best way to get tickets to all of the events that will be a part of this year. That's it for this week. We'll be back Tuesday with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. True Crime Tuesday, every Tuesday. You can find information about subscribing to that at darknessradio.com. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is Darkness Radio.